This is Ozarks at Large. In her new essay collection, Carrie, A Memoir of Survival on Stolen Land, author and University of Arkansas creative writing professor Tony Jensen confronts personal experiences on gun violence, race, gender, and the environment, and the language we use to talk about those things. Last week, she spoke with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth ahead of the book's release.
So, Tony, thanks for talking to me today. I appreciate it. I want to know just a little bit about the title of the book, just how you came up with Carrie and what it means with the themes that run through the book.
Sure. Well, Carrie's a book about gun violence. It's a memoir as well, so it's a personal book about gun violence. But also it has, I think, broader implications for other women and children, especially other Indigenous women and children. So I would say that the title, then, it has to do with campus carry. It has to do with the things we carry when we're affected by gun violence. So there are a lot of birds in the book, too. So probably what birds are carrying around on their day-to-day flights all around town, all around the country. So, yeah, I think it has those multiple implications.
Yeah. And the first essay that you open with, it starts out with Magpie Road and birds and talking about birds. But then it's also, I want to know why you chose that essay as the opener for the book, where you're at Standing Rock and in North Dakota. Why was it important for that one to be the opener?
That one covers a lot of ground as far as thematic work, and my editor and I both felt like it was a good one to open with, given that it covers environmental degradation of land. Of course, the water protector camps at Standing Rock were about trying to get the pipeline not to go in, right, under Lake Oahe. And so linking the environmental aspect of the book, or the place-based aspect of the book, with gun violence, with personal risk, with cultural risk, with, you know, bodies being put at risk. And so I think that one, probably more than any other, encompasses all of the elements of the book. And the road's called Magpie Road also, of course. And there's a book, this is a whole book then about birds and guns and land. And so it seemed to be a good place to start. Also, the history. That conflict captured America's imagination in a way that the everyday conflicts of Native American people all over the country, you know, don't normally capture the mainstream attention. I could tell you about three or four similar protests happening, you know, all around the country and in Canada right now, for example. But I realized that those aren't making the news in the way that the protests at Standing Rock did. And so, yeah, I think that it was good to center the book thematically, and also it just encompassed a whole lot of territory.
Yeah, and there was a section in that essay, I think you say, you and we and they don't understand Standing Rock. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, that section talks about the nature of conflict itself. I mean that it's longer standing than we give it credit for. It's not this one temporary moment, this one singular conflict. It's a conflict that dates back to the founding of the country, right? This thing we call America being discovered when, of course, there were already people here. And so the notion then that Standing Rock was one conflict versus a moment in time on a continuation of the same old conflict, really, in many ways. And so they're definitely part of a pattern that goes back historically.
This book is so specific and so singular to your experience. It is a memoir, and to your being Métis. When we see something like Standing Rock, it becomes this pan-Indigenous storyline. What are we missing when we're not seeing the specific stories of Indigenous people?
Something I think that I've had to learn living in the Southeast, since I'm not from here, is that each tribe has its own specificity. I knew that already, but something about living around Choctaw, Cherokee, Chickasaw, Osage people, Creek Nation too, with the success recently in court, and all of that already trying to be rolled back by the state of Oklahoma, that's a particular struggle. Those struggles and those incidents and those landmark decisions, when they come, affect everyone. We were all, I think, all of Indian Country was cheering on Creek Nation, right, for that decision. But the particulars of the land base, the particulars of the place, their particular history is discrete and distinct even from Cherokee history, let's say, or Choctaw or Chickasaw, right? And so, you know, Seminole, all of those are their own individual stories. And something about being here really brought that home for me. I lived on Dakota and Lakota territory lands for many, many years. But I think maybe because there weren't so many tribes there overlapping. So I think, yeah, it is important to see that that was the Standing Rock Sioux story, right? Versus having it be a Pan-Indian moment. It was Pan-Indian in that people came from all over the country and all over the world to support the Standing Rock Sioux, but that's their land. I think, yeah, it is important to center each conflict with its particular tribe.
And a lot of this book is, it's very rooted in place.
Yes.
And it kind of follows you from different places you've lived and places that are important to you.
Mm-hmm.
How is it to write about places that you've lived in and worked in and then a place where you are living now? What was that experience like?
It's harder to write about here because even though I've lived here now 6 years, I don't feel like I know it that well. I feel like though my voice has slipped into Southern diction and affect in many cases, I don't feel Southern and the South is still essentially very foreign to me. The other places I think I have more distance from and more of an understanding of. Most of them are out West or most of them are the middle of the country, you know, the upper Midwest. And so I think I have a greater understanding of those places than I do maybe the South. The South is still really interesting to me, but remains a little mysterious.
And then I do want to talk about the theme of gun violence that runs throughout the book. Why did you settle on that as kind of the overarching topic?
When I started writing the essays, some of the first essays that would become the greater book project, they were all place-based, as you already mentioned, and they were all also linked by gun violence. And eventually, it became very clear, summer of 2016, I think, you know, it just seemed like 2016 was really a moment of epic gun violence. Of course, unfortunately, since then, that hasn't stopped. But 2016 was when I really started thinking all of these probably would be linked by guns and gun violence.
And another thing that's linked there is about identity and gun violence. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Native people are the demographic most at risk in the United States for being shot, and especially being shot by police. And I think that will surprise certain people who would think that it would be Black people in America who would be the biggest demographic. And population-wise, it absolutely is Black people. But per capita, the prison population is the highest for Native people, and shootings by police are highest for Native people per capita, and rates of domestic violence are also the highest. And so it seemed impossible not to address that if I'm writing a book that includes gun violence, right? And it also seemed impossible to ignore, though, the face of gun violence right now, especially gun violence by police, is a Black face. It's not a Native face. And so to address that, not from a who has it worse sort of dynamic, because that doesn't benefit anyone, but rather from a place of lived solidarity and a place of the solidarity of the overlap of our stories since the beginning of the founding of this country.
And then another way that you talking about identity in the book struck me was, I think it one of the sections you were talking to a friend who said she was part Métis, and it was you parsing out which part of you and how we talk about identity and the language we use when we talk about how we identify.
Yeah, she was a friend who passed away who had talked about being part Kiowa. And I grew up with her. Of course I knew that. But it was the way that she used the language of the partial. Generally, Native people, when we speak about ourselves, unless we're explaining ourselves to non-Natives, say we're Kiowa or we're Métis. That language of the partial isn't how it works. It's not an ethnic identity. It's a citizenship. The partial isn't really a factor. You are or you aren't. And so that language of the partial is a carving up, in my view, that serves others. That's not an internal designation, but rather a performance for the exterior, for the outside world. And so, yeah, it was sad to me that she was carving herself up in that way.
Yeah, and does that affect how you employ language when you're writing or when you think about yourself and how you identify? Does it change the language that you use?
It's an interesting question because I'm sure there was a moment where I decided that, but maybe not. Maybe it's just always been that way. You know, when I hear different kinds of language from other people, especially younger people, it calls to mind that question of who are we identifying for and for what purpose? I remember I was reading somewhere and a young Native woman in the audience later put on Twitter that I had said something about that there was no need to carve ourselves up like that. The ways that we identify should be for each other and not for others. And I hadn't even remembered saying it, but I thought, yeah, I do feel that way. And that was the first time maybe that I became conscious that that's just how I address those issues.
And then another part of the book is that you wrote some of it during the pandemic.
I did.
How is it to write about being isolated and being in quarantine and going to the grocery store with a mask on and all of these things that seem normal or normal-ish now?
Yeah, we were in edits for the book. And there's a chapter in the book, late in the book, called Contagion. And I just thought, and my editor agreed, there's no way to have a chapter called Contagion that talks about contagion theory in relation to gun violence and not address also the very real coronavirus contagion that we're all contending with. So that chapter then was revised pretty late, obviously, since the book's already coming out, to include some of those pandemic concerns. And then other chapters were revised too, even later, to include the killing of George Floyd and the subsequent protests all over the country, because I've lived in some of those places. I've lived in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and it seemed very strange to me to be writing about gun violence and police violence and not include that incident, especially because my brother lives in St. Paul. I lived there. Yeah, it's a place I love and have a lot of friends and family still. So yeah, I think that revising the book in coronavirus times and writing part of it in coronavirus times, as well as the subsequent protests that are springing up everywhere, it's been very interesting. I don't know that it's so much been difficult, but I think we're all, or many of us anyway, are having difficulty focusing. And so the focus part, the actually putting your attention wholly into something like you need to when you're working on a book, is a challenge for everyone, more so probably for people who don't have the great privilege and luxury of working from home. You know, I mean, I think it would be impossible or very difficult to have a job where you go out and you risk your physical health and safety every day, and then you come home and you try to work on a book. I think that would be an immense challenge. I'm sure there are people all across America right now doing that very thing, but I feel really lucky to be in the position I am where I can work from home.
And then how is publishing the book now and doing press for the book, how has that changed?
A friend was texting me last night about how all of that was going. And I said, well, the main thing I enjoy about doing a reading is traveling to different places and seeing and meeting different people, people I haven't known before, or seeing old friends, that sort of a thing. The same with conferences where you sometimes promote your book. And so I'm trying then to reinvent this experience to look for ways that it can be fun or interesting, not just for me, but for obviously the people in the audience too, because I think there are people who don't like the in-person, who are really loving this virtual. I am not one of those people. And so I'm trying to figure out a way then, yeah, to have that be something that I enjoy.
And I did want to ask, too, because this is such, it's a memoir, it's so personal. When you were writing it or when you're now publishing it, mm-hmm. how does it feel to kind of give up some of those really personal things? I know some of the essays were published before, mm-hmm. but how is it to now introduce that to a wider audience?
Yeah, people are asking me that. And honestly, before I wrote the book, I made my peace with all of that. It was a decision. The first couple of essays, the first one, I think, to be published in a broad way was The Women in the Frack Lens, which is the first chapter of the book. Now it's revised, it's changed. But in writing that very personal essay and putting it out broadly, it got really a lot of hits. I decided after that, then if I was going to continue to do this, that I had to think about where my boundaries were in relation to my own life and my own stories. And those boundaries, I mean, it's all in there, really. I mean, I didn't hold much back. For me, what's been harder is thinking about other people's stories. So my family members who were in the book and their reactions, other people who were dear to me who were in the book and their reactions to having some of their stories that intersected with mine made public. I changed people's names. But still, yeah, what gave me the most pause was the sharing of other people's stories in relation to mine, not necessarily my own.
And so what do you hope people get out of the book when they read it? What do you want people to take away?
There's a lot, too, about language and the language we use to talk about our experiences with guns and gun violence. And I do hope that people take away that some of that language is not serving us. And there could be a cultural shift in language in the same way we've had cultural shifts in language about other issues. Domestic violence, for example. If someone shoots and kills his whole family, even if there are eight people in the family, that's an act of domestic violence. We don't call that a mass shooting. So those links have been talked about before, but I do hope by sharing these very personal stories that people will begin to rethink that narrative and also to connect it back to the beginning of the country itself, how the country was taken from Native people at gunpoint. We don't talk about that very often. We talk about removal like it happened politely versus that it was an armed conflict and not everyone was armed. And so I think those are some of the things I hope people will take away from the book.
That was Toni Jensen speaking with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth. Her essay collection, Carrie, a memoir of survival on stolen land, is out now from Ballantine Books.